Hi, it's Mountain Edition. All the news from the week here in the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay here with Wyatt Orme. Wyatt, how was your Thanksgiving last week?
It was very quiet. Thanks for asking.
Well, no time for turkey-induced comas here. We've got a ton of news to cover. From Glenwood Springs allowing more short-term vacation rentals, to the Wheelers' winter season, to more allegations of sexual misconduct at the Colorado State House.
Also, Basalt says it wants a little less talk and a little more action when it comes to a climate plan they signed on to. And we talked to a couple of Olympics-bound Nordic skiers about the impacts that a lack of snow has on their sport and on the ski industry.
The news from this week, coming up on Mountain Edition. A memorial service has been set for Valley native Colin Gibbard.
Allison Bechtesh reports.
Gibbard was born in Aspen, attended Basalt High School, and went on to study at the University of Northern Colorado. He worked in the Valley as a carpenter. This year, he became the framing supervisor for Peak Interiors. His brother, Evan, describes Gibbard as an open-hearted, loyal friend who adored his hometown.
He had a lot of love in his heart, and one big, big part of his heart was saved for this valley and especially for Aspen. He loved that town so much.
The family is in town through the weekend and invite friends to a memorial service this Saturday, December 2nd. The service begins at 10 a.m. with a reception to follow at the Orchard in Carbondale. 41-year-old Gibbard was found dead in Aspen last week. Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.
The Wheeler Opera House says it has curated its most diverse lineup of shows yet. Claire Woodcock has more.
From an all-male Argentinian dance company to a parody musical of the HBO fantasy series Game of Thrones, the 2018 winter season at the Wheeler demonstrates artistic range. Jenna Bueller is the Wheeler Opera House's executive director. It's her third winter with the historic venue.
We try to dive a little bit deeper into what diversity of programming really means.
More musical acts will be announced in the coming weeks. Claire Woodcock, Edlis Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That musical parody of Game of Thrones is going to be a must-see for a lot of the fans of the show.
I'll take your word for it. I don't watch Game of Thrones.
Oh.
Something else that's apparently a must-see for a lot of people is the Maroon Bells.
The U.S. Forest Service says more than 320,000 people biked, bused, or drove up to the Maroon Bells scenic area this season. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, that's another record-setting year.
The number of visitors to the Maroon Bells has grown by about 50,000 each year for the past three seasons. This year, the most popular month was September, when more than 65,000 people took a Roaring Fork Transportation Authority shuttle to see the fall colors. Shelley Grail is recreation manager on the Aspen Sopris Ranger District. She says the facilities at the Bells are designed to handle large crowds. Those thousands of visitors use more than a million rolls of toilet paper over the course of the season. But the ecosystem is not as durable.
We do see continued resource impacts, primarily around the lake where everybody wants to be.
Grail said Forest Service officials will discuss possible improvements to signage and trails to limit that damage. The number of cyclists using Maroon Creek Road continues to grow as well. Grail said the Forest Service is still considering how to best manage the varied uses, including a possible fee to ride the popular road. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
In 1982, the city of Aspen and Pitkin County signed an agreement creating the Aspen-Pitkin County Housing Authority. Here we are in 2017 with nearly 3,000 regulated units for sale and rent, and still in a housing crunch. Joining me to talk about the next 40 years of the program is reporter Allison Bechtesh. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Kristen.
So briefly, lay out the initial premise for APSHA.
The initial agreement, which has been re-upped continuously since then, states that we need a program that assures a supply of desirable and affordable housing for permanent residents, senior citizens, and this phrase, other population segments which are necessary for a balanced community. You know, Aspen was one of the first of its kind in a mountain town to create a program like this. That means we are also the first one to find out all the problems that might arise. I actually saw the term Aspenization used in a report for Park City. They had hired consultants who said, let's not make Aspen out of ourselves. So it became a negative. That term speaking more to the darkening of a city. Only 60% of Aspen's homes are owner-occupied. But there's also things that could have been done differently with our housing. We're seeing that no one wants to put in more money to their ownership units than they're ever going to get back out of it, since that's capped. And we're seeing that as our employee base retires, their jobs are opening up, but living spaces aren't.
And that caused some community discussion this fall.
That's a great way to put it, Kristen.
It's a diplomatic way to put it.
You know, but the issue's not new. Last summer, APSHA was showing that 20% of its stock would be occupied by those no longer working within the next 10 years. That means 600 new units were we to just recreate the demand we are filling right now. Everything I report on comes back to housing. Teacher retention issues that came up this fall. The Aspen Skiing Company, the hospital, all those executives tell me that the biggest issue is finding a workforce, because those talented people don't have a place to live. Obviously, transportation, chain stores and empty storefronts, that's a big issue in our town. Restaurants and local businesses say they can't make it with these dead zones. If we just have a population of visitors, how do you stay viable year round?
It sounds like it's time for a community discussion.
Kristen, I'm so excited. Obviously, you and I both think so. We're putting on this town hall discussion tonight. We do have this group of panelists who we've picked because they have so many different perspectives. Not only are they living in affordable housing, they also help create the program, or they're also regulating it. So I think we have a really solid crew, but the star of the show is going to be the people who are in the room. We have a couple special surprises to get community conversation going with this. That's where the solutions for the next 40 years are going to come.
I'm really looking forward to tonight.
I'm so excited.
All right. Thank you, Allison.
Thank you.
That town hall is the first of a series on housing. We'll talk about the original purpose of the APSHA program and whether it's fulfilling those goals. It's tonight at the Limelight from 5:30 to 7:30.
Now, in Colorado state news, a former legislative aide has filed a sexual harassment complaint against Republican State Senator Randy Baumgardner for inappropriately touching her.
Baumgardner is the representative from Garfield County. Benta Berkland has more.
The woman alleges Baumgardner slapped and grabbed her buttocks about four times during the 2016 legislative session. The formal process allows the complaint to remain private, which she wants out of fear of retribution. She says she came forward after we reported allegations from intern Megan Creedon about uncomfortable encounters with Baumgardner, also in 2016. Creedon says Baumgardner often pressured her to drink with him alone in his office, even though she didn't know him. When asked about the formal complaint, Baumgardner said he couldn't comment on specifics because the process is confidential. He added that he trusts it will allow the facts to be thoroughly investigated and all sides to be heard. He asked that the public not allow the media to be the final word on such matters. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orme.
And I'm Kristen Kay. And Wyatt, obviously, if people are listening to Mountain Edition, they want to stay in the know about local news.
Absolutely. And they can also stay on top of what's happening with Aspen Public Radio and throughout the community by liking our Facebook page.
On our Facebook page, you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
You can also see a photo of artist James Searles, who our arts reporter profiled this morning.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook. Earlier this year, the town of Basalt signed on to Eagle County's Climate Action Plan. But Basalt isn't going to commit any money toward the collaborative. Environment reporter Elizabeth Stewart-Severy is here to talk details. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kristen.
So what's in this plan and why did Basalt sign on?
The plan is all about reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So it sets targets of reducing 25% by 2025 and 80% by 2050. That's from a 2014 baseline. I spoke with Auden Schendler, who's on Basalt Town Council, and he says communities can waste a lot of time and money in researching and writing plans like this. So by signing on to Eagle County's plan, Basalt was able to save some of that and jump right into the implementation phase.
Okay, but Basalt doesn't plan to commit any funding to the Eagle County Collaborative.
Right.
Even though they're signed onto the plan. Why not?
Yeah, so the collaborative doesn't require any funding from its members. Members can choose to fund things like coordinated outreach or renewable energy infrastructure projects, but Basalt isn't doing that. Schendler says the plan is to watch how Eagle County works for this next year or so and then decide if those actions are really in line with the way Basalt wants to spend its money.
And the truth is, Basalt doesn't have a ton of money. We want to spend that money on efficiency projects.
So what are some of those projects?
Yeah, Schindler says there are some smaller projects underway to address things within the government, things like replacing the light bulbs and street lamps and improving the air sealing of town hall, things that Schindler admits should have been done long ago. And he says they've started on another key focus of Basalt's approach, which is advocacy. A huge percentage of the town's carbon footprint comes from electricity, and the town has started pushing Holy Cross to move to 100% clean energy by 2030. They've also joined some advocacy groups for action on climate at the state level. So the focus is really on policy.
Has Basalt taken any lessons from other communities like Aspen that have struggled to meet targets?
Yeah, I think it is revealing to watch really well-intentioned communities who are having a hard time moving the needle on greenhouse gas emissions. Schindler says watching that, he doesn't have a lot of faith in voluntary actions from individuals, and it's really about where Basalt goes from here. So it's not having a plan that's important, but it's actually the next steps. Here's what Schindler says.
The plans and the targets are not that meaningful. It's the implementation and advocacy that matters.
So Basalt kind of skipped the step of making the plans by jumping on to Eagle Counties, and now they're really working on that policy component.
All right. Thanks for your time, Elizabeth.
My pleasure.
Wyatt, our next story is about a phenomenon that is pretty unique to our valley. I'm talking about the Roaring Fork Swap.
It's how a lot of locals sell furniture or look for housing, but it's so much more than that. Allison Bektesh spoke with one of the site's managers about what it takes to keep an eye on the exchanges of material items, sure, but sometimes verbal ones too.
The Roaring Fork Swap is a Facebook group. It was created as sort of an online garage sale for people in the valley. But now, with nearly 24,000 members, that's three times the population of our area's biggest town, it's a society all of its own. There's still dressers and last year's skis for sale, but there's also humorous videos posted from within Grand Avenue Bridge traffic jams. There's threads with hundreds of commenters about the best place to get married in town. There's a recurring frazzled mother theme, posts thanking a stranger for helping to de-escalate a toddler tantrum in a grocery store. Once a thank you from a mom to whomever the stranger was that handed her a $100 bill, told her she was doing great, and walked away. I spoke with Jessica Rose. That's her Facebook name. She runs the swap page and doesn't give out her full name. She now has two other administrators who help monitor the group. I ask her what that job looks like.
There's a lot of things that happen on a day-to-day basis where we have to sort of calm the fury on the swap.
What does it look like? Do you have to wake up and check Facebook every day?
Oh, yeah. It's probably at least an hour a day for each of us to manage the swap. We get probably 35 to 40 new member requests a day, and that's our biggest job, is to check those member requests and decide if the person is real, if they really live in the valley. So we do get a lot of spam requests, and then people have the ability to report posts, and so we have to watch those and make sure that we decide if it can stay or go. Things like that.
Was there a post or a particularly big reaction to something that made you realize, oh, the dynamic of what this group is changing?
It's been really clear with the bridge construction in Glenwood. The Department of Transportation was following the swap and working with one of our other admins to make sure that they were hearing the complaints and the suggestions that people had for the traffic in Glenwood. That event with the bridge really made it clear to me that it is so much more than just a garage sale page on Facebook.
As the hub of the Roaring Fork community, by managing this page for the last 4 years, what have you learned about who we are?
So I think the biggest lesson I've learned from being an admin on the swap is that people are better than you think, and that there's more good than bad.
Jess Rose is one of the administrators of the Roaring Fork Swap, a community that has grown to 24,000 members throughout the Roaring Fork Valley. Jess, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Wyatt, when we look out our windows up at Aspen Mountain, it looks pretty bare up there right now.
It definitely does. It looks pretty bony.
There's less snow than usual in a lot of places across the globe, and that has complications for the ski industry and for professional snow sport athletes.
Professional skiers in a warming world find themselves in an icy position. Their livelihood relies on snow and cold temperatures, but essentials like travel and snowmaking come with an environmental cost. So how do athletes stand by their convictions and make a living? I checked in with some local Olympians to find out.
I don't know how to settle those two sides of the coin in my own mind.
Noah Hoffman is training for the Olympics and getting ready for the first World Cup race of the season. He's passionate about skiing, but he's also committed to environmentally sustainable practices. In the past couple of years on the World Cup circuit, Hoffman is finding that the two don't always mix. Hoffman's teammate and fellow Aspen native Simi Hamilton is the ninth fastest cross-country skier in the world. And late this fall, he hit the pavement on roller skis. There's not enough snow to train in Aspen yet, but that's something he's getting used to on the World Cup circuit. Year after year, Hamilton watches the snow line move further up the mountains.
We would be in the high Alps at 6,000 feet trying to train in the middle of January, and we'd still be training on just like a 2-foot deep platform of man-made snow, and there's just green grass right next to the trails.
A missed turn on this ribbon of snow means skiers get grass stains, and that's the new reality of cross-country skiing. But World Cup races go on, even with warming temperatures. Hoffman explains.
We never question whether a World Cup venue is going to have snow anymore because these guys have gotten so good at snow farming.
Yep, snow farming. It's a booming industry in Europe and Scandinavia, and it isn't a totally new idea. For decades, ski areas have supplemented natural snowfall with man-made stuff. The newest method involves blowing huge piles of snow in one central location and trucking it to fill in the course. And even this doesn't work when it's unseasonably warm. Snowmaking machines only work when temperatures are below freezing. All too often, nature doesn't cooperate until long after World Cup season starts in November. But Hoffman describes how race organizers have found a band-aid for this, too.
They hollow out a pit out of the earth in the dead of winter when it's almost always cold enough to blow snow. They blow as big of a pile as they can, essentially. And then they cover it with a couple inches of sawdust for the summer.
This may sound crazy, but it's becoming the norm across Scandinavia and at several venues in Europe.
All these places are saved snow over the summer so they can guarantee open by November 1st at the latest with last year's snow.
So as Hoffman and Hamilton prepare for the first World Cup races in Finland this month, they're sure they'll see snow, but it comes with a cost.
The hardest part is that snow farming is not environmentally friendly.
This is an energy-intensive process, cooling water, blowing snow, and powering trucks to cart it all around. It's a vicious cycle for these winter athletes. A warmer world means less snow. Less snow means more snowmaking. And, well, you get the point. But Hoffman and Hamilton are convinced this isn't a lost cause. Hamilton might not be a household name across the U.S., but he is a top athlete in a sport that's hugely popular in Scandinavia and other parts of Europe.
I want to be able to use that as a tool to generate interest and advocacy for something like climate change awareness and environmental sustainability.
He works with the group Protect Our Winters, a coalition of winter sports athletes who lobby for sustainable practices and climate awareness. For both of these athletes, racing on the international stage means moral conflict. Hoffman sounds pained when he describes the ways his racing contributes to climate change. Burning fossil fuels to travel the world, using water and energy to make snow, even releasing fluorocarbons as he waxes his skis. He also knows these problems, climate change and dwindling snow, are not caused by skiers alone, and he hopes his career can help more than it hurts.
I think that there are some benefits to professional cross-country skiing in terms of promoting a sport that is really healthy and promotes an active lifestyle and promotes a love for the environment and for being outdoors in the winter and for winter climate in general.
So even as Hoffman knows his Olympic dream contributes to the problem, that love for winter climate just might help the sport and even the planet. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Kristen Kay. In other local news, the Aspen Skiing Company is satisfied with the number of skiers and snowboarders who hit the slopes on Thanksgiving.
Students from Pakistan visited the Carbondale Community School this week.
Officials with Colorado Parks and Wildlife urged people to skip the shopping and get outside on Black Friday.
And winter season for the U.S. Forest Service has officially started. That means many roads are now closed to all vehicles with wheels, including bicycles.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org. This was the first year that all boats using Rudai Reservoir were screened for invasive species of mussels.
And as Elizabeth Stewart Savory reports, finding funding to continue the program will be no easy task.
You might even say that it will require some heavy lifting. I couldn't resist a bad mussel pun.
The Rudai Water and Power Authority limited recreation hours and spent nearly $100,000 on boat inspections last summer. That's about $10,000 more than expected, according to the agency's executive director, Mark Fuller. So far, these inspections have prevented the spread of zebra and quagga mussels, which have caused extensive damage to both ecosystems and infrastructure in other parts of the United States. But it takes a lot of resources. Inspectors had to be on site whenever the boat ramp was open. They screened more than 5,000 boats and decontaminated 112. The 2017 program was funded by 9 different agencies, and Fuller expects that next year, the 7 local governments that are part of the Rudai Water and Power Authority will again be asked to split the bill. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Renting out your extra room is easier than ever with online services like Airbnb and Vacation Rental by Owner. Things get harder for cities and towns trying to make sure everyone pays their taxes.
The Glenwood Springs City Council took steps recently to expand short-term rentals. This is amid an effort to make sure they're also all playing by the rules. Wyatt, you sat down with Allison Bechtesh to talk through the changes and who they'll affect.
Last week, the Glenwood Springs City Council decided what exactly?
They're thinking about lifting restrictions on short-term rentals in 9 different developments. So there are 9 different what are called residential PUDs. And when I say PUD, this stands for Planned Unit Development. PUD more often than not refers to a large subdivision. So people living in this PUD zone, they have not been able to rent out their homes on a short-term basis, which means 30 days or less.
Why not?
The answer is kind of boring. It wasn't included in the development code. But the big picture here is that Glenwood Springs wants to simplify its zoning code. It's working towards being able to say, okay, everyone can rent out their home on Airbnb or VRBO, but you need to register with the city and you need to be paying both sales and lodging tax.
Okay, so what would be the upshot of this?
Well, the council still needs to have the second reading on this, but should it pass, it basically opens up Airbnb and VRBO as a possibility to 700 more units within Glenwood Springs.
Wow.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that Glenwood Springs is suddenly going to have like 700 more Airbnb listings. Right now, the entire city has 68 homes that are on either Airbnb or VRBO. Hannah Klassman, who's a planner with the city, told me she's skeptical that this is going to lead to some kind of flood of new short-term rental properties.
I can definitively say that there's 5 that will likely become short-term rentals out of those 677.
Mm-hmm.
The remainder, you know, is anyone's guess.
Okay, but does this affect anyone in town?
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, I spoke to Barbara Hilly. She's the general manager of the Caravan Inn. She essentially told me the more Airbnb, the fewer customers for her.
So these neighborhoods that currently aren't allowed to be renting out rooms, are people right now listing their homes on websites?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely can. There is a risk, though. There are penalties for not registering with the city that can be as severe as $1,000 per day.
So do we know if people are flying under the radar?
Yeah, Hannah Klassman told me that there are currently 18 violators in the entire city. And in the PUD zone, this zone in question, there are 3 violators. But should the ordinance pass, these so-called violators will have the chance to formalize their short-term rentals because it will then be legal.
Also interesting. Thank you, Wyatt.
You're welcome.
Our last story today is about art in unexpected places.
Claire Woodcock visited Carbondale artist James Searles to talk about a new sculpture exhibition he's preparing to open at the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport early next year.
And this exhibit won't be one you roll by while you're on the moving sidewalk with your suitcases. It's in a little more unusual spot.
James Searles is carving a petal out of a block of wood.
This is big, more like a fence post, whereas that one is more delicate and formed like the petal of a flower. But either way, the process is the same thing.
His warehouse-sized studio sits on the hill of a county road in Missouri Heights. It looks out at a snowy Mount Sopris and the jagged peaks of the Elk Range. The studio smells like fresh-cut wood. Sculptures made from wood and steel spring from the floor, cling to the wall, and dangle from the ceiling. Though Searles has expressed himself with other mediums, he says he's long preferred woodworking.
The idea of chopping something, it's been around for thousands and thousands of years. We as humans have hewed out shapes of all sorts.
When creating a piece, Searles says the philosophy and the science of his work carry as much weight as the aesthetics.
I mean, when you look at art, you really do have to ask it the basic questions of what are you? What are you doing? What are you saying? And it's kind of nice when the art can take you somewhere.
On this day, Searles doesn't have much time to tinker in his toy shop. He's about to leave town for a gallery opening with his wife, artist Charmaine Locke. The pair relocated to Carbondale together in the late 90s after raising their family in Texas. That's where Searles grew up.
In what I call nature's lap. My grandmother had a thorn tree hedge around her house that was virtually impenetrable. When I was little, I was very aware of it because it was all through the fields, you know, so we would run through the fields and playing, and there would be things that would stick you.
Although he's exhibited in major galleries worldwide, he says he's used to his work landing in unconventional places, like the Roundabout in Carbondale. His latest venture takes his sculptures to the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport's new duty-free shop.
Man, it's kind of a high-dollar enterprise. You know, they sell lipstick and perfumes and, you know, really nice bottles of whiskey.
And in the center of the store will be some of Searles' largest sculptures, acting as part of a rotating exhibit.
Where I'm taking my art to is not a traditional art place.
In order to see it, you need to be a ticketed international traveler flying in or out of Dallas.
It's people who have the means to travel. It's people who have the means to fly from one capital to another. Listen, I know all about where you show and where you don't and why you do and why you don't.
But no matter where it's shown, his work is still art, and he's not above trying alternative galleries.
It's just a fact of life if you want to make a living doing what I do. So, yeah, I would go there. I would go show in the terminal. You know, I would go show at a duty-free. I'll take it. I'll go play in their river.
The new duty-free at DFW will open the first week of February. Claire Woodcock, Aspen Public Radio News.
Well, it's time for us to fly on out of here. That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and national and international news on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune into Valley Roundup tomorrow at 3:30. We'll talk to Randy Essex, the outgoing editor of the Glenwood Post-Independent, about the biggest stories he's covered in his career here.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.